Mr. Charlie Chia Fu in Rule 7.
Yeah, the Japanese could not afford, and it was definitely absurd for them to lock the people up for the whole day and night. So they allowed the people to go about their way as long as they did not create or cause any disturbance. Therefore, all these activities, they just simply close an, a blind eye to it and let it operate as though they did not know of its existence.
Did you know whether the gambling stalls at the amusement parks, whether the owners had to take license from the Japanese government?
That I am not aware of, you see. But in those days, if you knew someone, it was quite easy to get whatever you want. You see? Even rice, if you knew someone, it was small matter, you see. Then we come back, I think we come back to means of transport at that time. At that time, I recollect the traction company that operate those trolley buses of theirs. I think the private buses were taken off the roads. And at a later stage, they did operate these charcoal lorries, taxis. You see, some individuals, they just use their old cars. I don't know how they converted into charcoal, because petrol was very strictly rationed, and it was only the high-ups or the local population who could get petrol. See. Other than that, the main means of transport was your two legs. You just simply walked, you never dreamt of trying to get a public or a private transport, you see. Unless you were one of the few privileged people.
Who ran the public transport?
The only public transport was the these trolley buses and some of these charcoal-operated taxis.
What was the name of the company which owned these trolley buses?
Well, it was the traction company who operated it, but whether they formed a company to run it otherwise, I've got no idea.
It was not managed by the Japanese?
Of course, it was managed. They put a civilian, you see, to be in charge.
Japanese civilians.
Japanese civilians. At that time, they brought in quite a number of these Japanese civilians, you see, to run the civil administration.
Coming back to the gambling in the amusement parks. So, did you know whether it was necessary to have a license?
That I'm not aware. All that I know is that they were in existence. And I've been down a couple of times or so. Mm-hmm.
What kind of people would go to the amusement parks?
Oh, you meet all sorts of people in these places, you see. So there was nothing particular about any one section or so. So you just know, oh, there are these stalls there. you operate, what hours, and you wish, you just dropped in.
Were there any, besides the Chinese, were there any other race who went to the amusement parks?
No, of course it would be the majority would be Chinese, you see, with very few exceptions of other races. Because the Chinese, you had a major population then, you see. So other than that, most probably the other races had their own form of passing the day, see, of which I was not aware of.
What about the Japanese? Did they go to those places also?
No, maybe a few Japanese civilians did frequent, you see, did frequent those places. But as far as I know, no military personnel did frequent.
Besides the gambling stores, what else were there in the amusement parks?
I can't recollect anything other than these gambling stores.
Do you remember the hours of operation?
The hours of operation was something from 7 to midnight or so, dependent on the crowd, usually about 12.
Do you remember whether there were any kind of lotteries during that time?
Well, lotteries, when you talk of lotteries, it all depends on you, in what context, you see. Well, you can call that, you can't call the Qifa a lottery. Still, it was only a game of chance. Like the Chabiki.
Lottery sponsored by the Japanese government?
No.
You did not know?
No, not in that sense.
During that time, you mentioned that you were working at the Harbour Board for a while.
I think it was about a month after. Then I worked as a laborer, honorary laborer in the harbor board, mostly on ships in the cargo holds, unloading and loading goods. Sometimes when there were no ships, we just simply worked on the wharfs and go downs, did the sweeping.
Did you remember how did you get this job?
No, there was no introduction was necessary. See, all that, if you know where they picked up the laborers, you just simply go there and line up, and that is first thing in the morning, I think before 7 o'clock, and that is outside the old Singapore Harbour Board police station on the roadside. You just line up, you see there's a long queue there with these Indian bandos. So you just squat there and wait for the Japanese work parties to come along and pick you up.
Where was the old police station?
The old police station was somewhere behind the defunct Tanjung Pagar police station.
So was it a daily kind of work or was it?
It was daily, you know. You were paid in the evening when you finish, or if they enforced overtime, they paid you the next morning. The contractor paid you the next morning, you see. All these were operated by contractors. You were provided with a meal and paid 55 cents per day. Your meal consisted of a big packet of rice, quite sufficient for a normal person, with dal, you see, and plenty of gravy. Much of filling at the time, you see. You just open the packet and you use your five fingers.
What were your working hours like then?
You lined up around 7 and you wait for the Japanese soldiers to come along and pick up the various teams with the mandos, and then you follow them to where your allotted place of work. And therein, I think you work. By the time you reach your place of work, it will be any, dependent on which part of the harbor you were allotted. You see, you could reach there, and there were no lorries to pick you up. You just foxtrot, you see. It could be anything from 7:30 to 8 o'clock before you arrived. And therein you worked up to, I think, 12 o'clock. You had your lunch break, 1 hour. After that you started again. You finished at about 5. And therein the mando, of course, when you reached the workplace, the mando would have given you a paste board, you see. So at the end of the day, he would be down there waiting for you, you see. So you hand in your paste board, you got your 55 cents.
Did you need any kind of pass or security check before you enter the...
No. You had the Japanese soldier to lead you along, so there were no checks, you see. But off and on, when you leave, they do frisk you at the entrance.
What kind of goods were you unloading from the ships?
Well, for the short period, a few months that I was there, I unloaded rice, sugar, salt, copra, and cement. Rice, that's quite all right to unload. And of course the best would be sugar, where you could dig your finger in and scoop out sugar. You see, it's all a luxury then, you know. So it's no problem. But salt would be bad to work on a hot day. It really make you your throat dry up. Cement is the worst of the lot. You're down in the cargo hold, you will have to unload the cement. You'll find your whole body, exposed body, and even the cement dust gets into other parts of the body. And at the end of the day, you find yourself all coated with cement. And it so happened that the first time I worked on unloading cement, I had to work the whole day and the whole night. I was only released in the morning. Because after the evening break, the Japanese posted sentries, you see. They marked that there was no way out unless one tried to take a risk. Because they knew that the laborers would be unwilling. So they had it surrounded, guarded all around. No civilians were allowed. And this was one very bitter experience where I went home next morning. I had hell of a time cleaning off that cement dust. I had to use coconut oil and whatnot, and even then it took me 2 days. And even then it was not all. Still there was some sticking over the body. And I also worked on this, the loading of scrap metal. But that is both from on the wharf and in the cargo hold. And this loading and unloading of scrap metal could be very dangerous. Because if one was not careful, you had only to, when they hoisted, you had to get a knock and things could happen, you see. And same when you're working in a cargo hold with a limited space there, you see.
The scrap metal was being sent out to
I can only assume sent back to Japan, you see.
Who were the people who were working there with you?
Oh, we had all sorts of nationalities, you see. Even some were prisoners of war who were sent to work in the godowns, you see.
How did the Japanese treat all of you?
Well, human beings being what they are, you've got the good and the bad ones, you see. But one thing I can tell you, there's supposed to be 10 laborers in a group with one mando. All right, you start with 10. Within half an hour, 1 hour, there remain only 8 or maybe even 7. After an hour or more, it could even go less. These chaps, on the pretext of going to a toilet, they don't come back until lunchtime. You see, they took a risk. And that is how throughout my whole period, I found the situation of these laborers to be where one had to do the work of almost 2 men or more. But the Japanese took quite a liberal view of this.
Did they enforce any kind of security or discipline in the harbor?
No, you were just, you go down the cargo hold, you were left to work. When the sling came down, you loaded it. Yeah? If you're on the wharf, what comes on, you unload. Or if you have to load, when the sling comes on, you load. That's all.
Do you remember whether there were any incidents where people were caught not doing their work?
Well, what I've heard is that those that sneaked off were caught they were, what you say, beaten up. But of course, these chaps, I presume they're accustomed to these sort of treatment, and it's apparently, it's nothing new to them.
While you were working there, do you have any kind of pleasant or unpleasant experiences that happened to you?
Oh no, I just took no notice, created no trouble, went about what I had to do in my own way. I did not object neither that past remarks, you see. I kept discretion as the better part of valor. Whether it was four chaps remaining in the cargo hold or five chaps, whatever it is, I did whatever was my fair share, that's all. See, I didn't even pass any remarks and say, oh, you see. No, it was not advisable to speak your mind.
You worked there for a few months only?
Only a few months, because after that, I had appendicitis, you see. I had appendicitis, and I went for an operation at the Kadakaba Hospital, you see. And after I was in the hospital for about 1 week, after that, I was badly weakened. And it took me another 1-2 weeks to recover. When after I recovered, I went down to the shops in Tiong Bahru. I was staying close by there. And I found out from friends that the United Engineers were taking in men. Not for clerical duties, but for this skill work. So I said, okay. The chap who was recruiting was known to my friends, so no problem on that. So next morning, I just arranged to meet my friend, and we went down. And I and my friends, there were three of us. We were allotted what they call in Cantonese was on kung or something, which had to do, which dealt with the making of these Japanese leather military equipment. Such as belts, bullet pouches, the leather bags which is strapped behind the bags, and these bayonet holders, all these various, you see. The three of us soon learned. None of us had ever held a cobbler's knife in our hands, you see, or did any of the stitching. But we soon learned the trick of the trade. It was no problem learning it. And we got along pretty well with the Japanese, you see. After some time, some or other, I befriended the Japanese lieutenant in charge of the section, and therein the sergeant, Japanese sergeant, noticing this, they took me off from the ordinary duties and put me down to work this, do some clerical work. But of course I did not know this Chinese, and therein it was pretty difficult, you see. Then they sent me back to the workbench, and they found that my work was good, so they tested me, you see. They gave me a design of a pouch, and they asked me, gave me the leather and all that. They asked me to cut one out and to stitch it. I did it. They were satisfied with it. Therein they promoted me to be the second foreman of the factory. We had at one time about 100 odd females, adults and kids working, and about 80 males in the factory.
The factory was United Engineers.
United Engineers.
Who was in charge of the factory at that time?
At that time, it was a Japanese sergeant, you see. But off and on, he had to go down maybe to the head office, most probably for some administrative work or so, you see. And it was left to, I think, three or four of these Japanese soldiers to run the factory. And I do recollect the sergeant in his absence. There was this lance corporal or so, okay, who ran the workshop, because he was conversant with it. And then there were two Japanese soldiers whom you can say were somewhat like hooligans, you see. One of them did behave pretty badly. The other one, although he was like hooligan type, he was quite decent. And they always kept this rascal in hand, you see. Of course, he would sit beside the female workers, and therein sometimes he created trouble, and Lance Corporal and the other one had to step in. You could see that he's not a normal chap. Like, when he's annoyed, he'll more or less growl like an animal, you see. But of course, you had the other tough guy around. He dare not issue the challenge, you see. So work went on like that. And then at the beginning, it was only normal working hours. No night work. As time went on, there was night work. And when there was night work in the evenings, they had some sort of these cakes or what, tapioca cakes or what, which they sold to the staff at a very cheap price.